York Yankees catcher Yogi Berra once said about planning, if you don't know where you're going, you'll end up someplace else. I am Rob West. Well, old Yogi was a master of unintended humor, but he sure was right about planning. And planning for retirement is hard if you don't have all the facts. I've got several for you today, and then it's on to your calls at 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. This is MoneyWise Live, biblical wisdom for your financial journey. Well, you work hard all your life, so you don't want your retirement day to roll around and find you're someplace else. Having all the facts is critical if you want to avoid surprises, and better to have the facts now while you can still make needed adjustments to your financial plan. Our first fact is certainly good news. The odds are you'll probably live longer than you think. But unfortunately, that will also likely put more strain on your retirement savings. You may have heard that the average life expectancy is around 79, but that's the average for all age groups combined, and that makes the figure somewhat misleading. If you look at the life expectancy only for those who make it to age 65, and 70% of us will live at least that long, half of women reaching that age live to at least 87, and half of men reaching 65 will make it to 84. That means younger workers should plan for 20 years or more of income in retirement, and those folks currently retired who may still have all their assets in fixed income securities should move some of it, 20 to 30%, into index or mutual funds to offset inflation or risk running out of retirement savings someday. Now, the next fact shouldn't surprise anyone, but it seems like it does. For the vast majority of people, Social Security won't come close to meeting your income needs in retirement. Financial advisors recommend having a retirement income of around 75 to 80% of your working income. Social Security was never intended to do that. At most, you can depend on Social Security for around 40% of the income you'll need in retirement. The solution, again, is to increase your retirement holdings. The sooner you do it, the easier it is because of compound earnings. Now, our next retirement fact is that most Americans aren't saving enough for retirement. Again, no surprise. The median retirement savings for Americans aged 55 to 64 is only $107,000. If that seems like a lot, you may be disappointed. You can only safely withdraw 4% of that a year, or you'll begin drawing down the principal of your retirement holdings. That amounts to just $350 a month, not much of a supplement to Social Security. And remember, $107,000 was the median savings, meaning half of workers approaching retirement have less than that. There was a time when pensions were commonplace. Social Security was really designed back in the 1930s for folks who didn't have a pension. Today, the vast majority of workers don't have that benefit, and for those that do, the median annual payout is just over $9,000 a year. That means most workers absolutely must have a defined contribution plan like a 401k or IRA. But according to a report by Vanguard, a third of American workers have no workplace retirement plan. The solution is obvious. If you're not saving in a qualified retirement plan, open one and start today. All of this leads us to our next fact about retirement. Since so many these days are financially unprepared for it, many are staying in the workplace well after they reach Social Security eligibility. Bloomberg reports that nearly 20% of people 65 and older are still working full or part-time. The Bureau of Labor Statistics puts the actual number of those workers at around 10 million. One out of five workers of all ages say they'll never be able to retire. And one more retirement fact for you, and this one has to do with Medicare. A lot of folks think that once they reach age 65, Medicare will cover all of their health care needs. It won't. For example, Medicare doesn't cover most assisted living expenses. And studies show that around 70% of those reaching 65 will need long-term care, which could run more than $4,000 a month. Medicare covers only the first 100 days of care at a skilled nursing facility, and only then if it results from a hospital stay of 3 days or more. The solution there is long-term care insurance, which, as you probably know, can be quite expensive. The best time to buy it is in your mid-50s, and you want to get the longest term offered. I hope that's helpful. Your calls are next, 800-525-7000. I'm Rob West, and we'll be right back. Stick around. Thanks for joining us today on MoneyWise Live. I'm Rob West, your host. This is where we apply the wisdom from the Bible to your financial decisions and choices. We've got some lines open today, 800-525-7000. It would be our privilege to speak to you today to understand what's going on in your financial life and see if we can help you move forward. Again, 800-525-7000. We've got a number of lines open today. And Clara, managing our phones, you'll be able to speak to her, and we'll try to get you on the air quickly. As we talk today in our opening segment about retirement facts, it's a good time to mention that if you need professional help with your investing, insurance, or estate planning needs, you might want to consider finding a certified Kingdom advisor in your area. These financial, legal, and accounting professionals have completed a rigorous certification program to give biblically wise financial advice as a part of their practice. They've also met high standards in character and competence, also have furnished pastor and client references, and met an extensive experience requirement as well. You can find a local certified Kingdom Advisor professional by going to moneywise.org and clicking the button that says Find ACKA. All right, we're going to dive into your questions today. You know, what would I say if you were to hear the state, or what would you say to the statement, the way you handle money is the clearest indicator into what's going on in your life spiritually? Well, the late Larry Burkett used to say that all the time. That's a convicting question to ask, isn't it? It's convicting for me. I'm sure it is for you as well. And the question really drives to the idea that if money is really the most tangible evidence of what's going on in our lives, it's the way we work out our values and our priorities, our checkbook, check register, if we don't use that anymore, our digital financial account record is a clear indicator into where our priorities are, what's important to us. And that really follows this idea, what Jesus said, and that was, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. So if the way we're handling our money doesn't tell the story we want it to tell about what is in fact truly important to us, perhaps it's time to take a hard look at how our values intersect with the financial decisions and choices we're making every day. As we live within our means and avoid the use of debt and have some long-term goals and some margin in our financial life. And yes, as we give generously. Well, and that's what we try to do here on this program every day, is encourage you as you lean into the scriptures and apply God's wisdom to the financial decisions you're making every day. All right, let's head to the phones again, 800-525-7000. We've got a few lines open. We're going to begin today in Pittsburgh. Hey, Danae, thanks for calling. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Sure. My question today is we have a couple just small investment properties. They're just duplexes that my husband and I had purchased as a way to have some income coming in for our retirement years.
Yeah.
But we've had much difficulty, especially during COVID. We weren't able to, you know, we could take people to the magistrate to try to get rent, but they didn't have to pay it. And so we took quite a hit during COVID. And it doesn't seem to be getting a whole lot better because there's still all the COVID money out there. And so they're getting lots of help, but they can apply for this assistance. But then we don't get it for like 3 months after. So we're not getting any rent for like 3 months. And the one building in particular, we pay all the utilities. So at this point, my husband and I are trying to decide, should we stay the course, keep the properties, hope things get better, and then we have that income for our retirement years, or we're both actually in our early 50s, or should we sell the property, just pay off our mortgage, and stay the course and keep the properties that, you know, we do have that money.
Yeah, good. Danae, obviously being a landlord can be a real challenge. It's not for everyone. COVID and the moratoriums on evicting non-paying renters have certainly made that more difficult. You're speaking to some of the challenges there. From a simple business perspective, are you in the black on the rentals with cash flow, you know, as you look at just kind of how this has played out over the last year?
Yeah, we don't have any mortgages on the places that we have. That we just have a few, and we don't have any mortgages. And right now, we're doing okay. There for a while, we weren't during COVID. It was pretty bad, but we're doing all okay. But we're still having very much difficulties with having tenants pay the rent, and it's a lot of frustration and headaches.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, obviously these are cash flowing positively, and that's largely driven by the fact that you've tied up so much money in the properties. I love the fact that you're debt free, and this allows you to build an uncorrelated, investment that's different than the other asset classes like stocks and bonds. Are you all also saving outside of this in retirement accounts, or has this, prevented you from doing that?
No, we do have some. We had arrived at that game later in life, my husband and I. We were young, didn't have real good job. I had stayed home with my children, so I didn't have a job for 12 years. And then when I did start working, I had started a nonprofit, and I didn't have access to a retirement plan. So we felt like we got in late, and so we don't have the kind of money that you should have when you're 50 years old. So, we had bought these properties thinking, oh, well, we'll have that. But, now we just don't know, because we do carry a mortgage on our house, our personal house. So we thought, should we try to get rid of that or, stay the course?
Yeah. So I think what this comes down to is really, number one, the appreciation that you're experiencing. So if you're at least generating enough to cover the maintenance and reserves, taxes and insurance, and you're throwing off a decent amount of income that you could then reinvest perhaps into tax deferred environments, that's obviously a positive. And then at the same time, you've got all the equity, but you're experiencing the appreciation in the asset, and real estate historically has done well. So I think, from that standpoint, it probably makes sense, as long as, these particular properties, either location or the kind of property they are, is not experiencing as much appreciation. But then the second element of the equation here is the non-financial side, which is just, do you all want to be landlords moving forward? I realize you're a little jaded perhaps from the COVID years. If it's better now and you're comfortable staying the course, I think that's a kind of a hard conversation you and your husband need to have. How much time is this taking for us to do this? And do we enjoy this work? Is it worth it? Or would we rather liquidate this and move toward a more passive investment, while real estate prices are still high? Should we take this, move out of this, and move it into the market where prices are low? We've had a significant sell-off here, and perhaps that more passive investment, given the timing of the high real estate market, even though it's softened a bit, but moving into stocks and bonds, which is, declined significantly in value, that then accomplishes several things. It, moves you to a passive environment where you're getting out of being a landlord and you're taking advantage of these depreciated prices. So I think that's one option to consider. I'm not negative on real estate. If this is something you all wouldn't mind continuing to do now that things have improved, then I think you could make a case for just continuing to stay the course, so long as you take that money and redeploy it into other asset classes, namely stocks and bonds. But give me your thoughts quickly. I've got about 30 seconds.
I think that's good. I guess our big question was, should we stay the course or should we get our own mortgage paid off? So
yeah, and that really comes down to a conviction on your part. There's not a huge benefit in you paying off your mortgage versus keeping this. It really just comes down to which is going to, both are appreciating at the same rate. And I think it really comes down to, would you have more peace of mind if your home was paid off in full? Or are you comfortable maintaining that mortgage and having two assets appreciating at the same time? We've got to hit a break. You stay on the line. We'll talk a little bit more off the air, and we'll be right back. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us today on MoneyWise Live. We talked to Danae off the air there for a few moments, and
where we concluded was, you know, she and her husband are on pace to pay off their current residence in the next 5 years. I said, really, as long as they have that paid off by retirement, sooner is better. But at least by retirement, that's the key, because that's going to take this biggest expense out of the equation in terms of their lifestyle. And then they're left with this ultimate decision: is the best place to grow our wealth in real estate, with that huge chunk allocated to a duplex, and sounds like maybe even a triplex that's completely paid off, that's appreciating, but has a good bit of work along with it as a landlord, or in stocks and bonds. And she concluded, you know what, we kind of like real estate. We don't really like the volatility of stocks and bonds. So they're going to hang on to that property and perhaps think about taking the cash flow plus the other surplus they have and try to build up their investable assets each month moving forward. So they have both of these assets growing over time. Danae, we appreciate your call today. We've got a few lines open. 800-525-7000 is the number to call. Let's head back to the phones. East Lake, Ohio. Hey, Al, thanks for calling, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great.
Certainly appreciate you taking my call. I do have a question for you. I recently retired. I retired early, and my company had a really good stock sharing. And I had a real good chunk in that stock sharing. So I had 1K, and then when they released the stocks, I put those in an RIA or IRA. But I'm just wondering, I also put a good chunk of money because I was worried about, like, income down the road. Like, I wanted some guaranteed income. I put, like, in an annuity, so I have guaranteed income for 20 years. I just wanted your thoughts on, like, guaranteed income, and because I know I'm not making a lot of money on that, but also it's taking a little of the risk out. What are your thoughts on that, please?
Yeah, you know, I'm not a huge fan, Al, of insurance products for long-term savings. One of the benefits is clearly what you just described, and that's guaranteed income. If that's what you're looking for, to transfer the risk away from yourself and the market risk to an insurance company that's going to provide you a guaranteed return, if a fixed income, clearly a guaranteed return, or a variable product, at least a floor where you're not losing money and you get a portion of the upside. And then obviously there's customizable features. There's all kinds of varieties of these things. The reason I don't love them is there are some tax penalties associated with them. They tend to have high commissions and fees and surrender charges. So if you want to get your money back, you know, it can be challenging, at least for a period of time, without taking a hit on that. And they tend to be complicated. So they just, you know, in some cases are difficult to understand. And so I'd rather, if you have the right time horizon with the right investment mix, get the full benefit of the money working for you, 100% of the upside, and with that, assume the downside risk as well. But if this gives you peace of mind, I can certainly appreciate that. And I think there's something to be said about knowing that at least for this portion of your retirement assets, you do have that guaranteed income that you can count on, that you can use to supplement security and a social security and whatever else you have, then it could be invested, and that would be above this amount. So I'm not opposed to it, although it's generally not my first choice. Does that make sense?
It makes perfectly sense. I definitely certainly appreciate it. If you have time for just one more little part of that question.
Yeah, sure.
Like, what I have in the stock market right now is like 60-40. So it's, you know, 60% stocks. And I know I've been taking a lump on that lately, but you know, that's just a ride the course thing, right? You just got to kind of ride it out. I know stocks are low right now, and I bought when they were really low, but it's going to take a wallop for a while.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and sometimes we need some encouragement in the midst of a market like we're in, like this. So let me offer that. You know, yeah, you've got to just take a long-term view and recognize that during the past, you know, dozen years, we had a raging bull market with easy money and low interest rates and a lot of strong corporate earnings, strong consumer, you know, post the Great Recession. And, you know, obviously we're paying the price for some of that that was brought on in part through COVID, the pandemic, and supply chain issues, but really largely just the incredible monetary policy and stimulus and all the easy money policies that we've had for a long time. That comes to roost in the form of inflation, and we're experiencing that in a significant way right now. And the Fed has acknowledged this is not temporary or transitory. This is something that's real, and they came a little late to the party, but their gloves are off, and they're, you know, going to fight fight inflation with every tool at their disposal, namely raising interest rates at a pretty good clip. In fact, historically, it's been really fast. And that will continue, at least that's what they're saying, until we see signs that inflation is going to moderate. So given that, the market's going to be under some pressure because there's a fairly good chance that we could see at least a mild recession as we close out this year and into next year. Now, the market will recover ahead of the economy. And so that's why it doesn't make sense, even in a period like this, to get out of the market and go to cash, because there's just no way to determine when that recovery will occur. Just ask the folks who got out of the market at the beginning of the pandemic, only to see the fastest bear market turn into the fastest bull market in history as the recovery happened very quickly. And it'll be a little, you know, more prolonged in this case, just given some of the uncertainties and that it's going to take more time to work its way through the system, but the market will recover. Longer term, we've got some real challenges and headwinds that have macro trends attached to them. But, you know, everybody that I trust, economists that are God-fearing people that really are skilled in this area, believe that we will get through this. It won't be terribly painful in terms of the recession itself, and the market will recover. And if that's the case, and we believe that's true, then this is a time not to actually retreat, but to lean in and say, we're going to continue to invest because right now I can buy more shares with the same amount of money. And so now's the time to continue my investments. Does that all make sense?
Boy, that makes perfectly sense. I'll tell you what, you are Mr. Educated on this topic.
Well, I appreciate your call, Al. Thanks for listening and calling in today. We're grateful for our time with you. If we can help you further down the road, don't hesitate to reach out. Dan, Ken, Lisa, Lori, we're coming your way. We also have a few extra lines open today at 800-525-7000. You know, as we go back to God's Word, we see some clear principles. We should live within our means. We should avoid debt. We should have some liquidity in our financial lives. We need to have a long-term perspective, so we need to set long-term goals. And we need to give generously. And if we do that, we'll experience God's best. We'll be right back on MoneyWise Live. Thanks for joining us today on MoneyWise Live. God's wisdom for your financial decisions. Not because it comes from me, but because it comes from God's Word. We try to pull the principles of the Bible out to apply to your financial decisions and choices. All the lines are full, which means we need to go back to the phones. Akron, Ohio. Hey, Dan, thanks for your patience. Go right ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I will be turning 70 in January of 2023. And I hear there will probably be an 8% increase or a little more in Social Security in January of 2023.
Yes.
So to get that increase, do I need to start my benefits in December 2022 at age 69 and 11 months for the increase to be credited to an open account? Or if I start my benefits in January 2023, which would be first paycheck in February of 2023, will the 8% be added to such from my very first month onward?
Yeah, you don't have to do anything to receive that Social Security cost of living increase, Dan. It will happen automatically, and it'll be applied at any point based on whenever you start collecting. So you will enjoy that adjustment along with everybody else as you receive those benefits. 66 million Americans will receive those benefits, and that annual inflation adjustment, as you said, we won't know officially what it is until tomorrow. That's when it's released. But based on the inflation data so far, we're hearing that it could be as much as 8.7%. Now, we'll have to watch that. I mean, that would translate into an average monthly increase of about $144, which boosts the typical benefit from $1,658 to about $1,802. So a huge increase, but that's alongside massive increases in the cost of living as a result of inflation. So it sounds good, but it's just offsetting what these Americans have already been spending in terms of higher prices. But to answer your question, you don't have to do anything. It'll come automatically, okay?
So the account doesn't have to be open. When I open it, like in January, to be paid in February, it will be accredited to all new accounts.
Yes, sir. That's exactly right.
Thank you.
Okay, Dan. Thank you for your call, sir. We appreciate it. To Cleveland, Ohio, Ken, you're next on the program. Go ahead.
Awesome. Hey, three Northeast Ohio in a row. This is cool. Hey, first of all, thanks for taking my call. A big shout out to the KM Advisors, too. First of all, we've been with ours for over 20 years. And
wow.
The godly guidance we received from the KM Advisors has just been spectacular. So,
oh, that's incredible.
Your,
support, so glad
promotion
to hear
that. Thought I'd go ahead and share that kudos with you. Hey, listen, I'm set to inherit about a couple $100,000. And I'm probably about 10 years away from retirement. We have about $400,000 in IRA and 401k at this point. We've got some, some mortgage debt at like 2.4%. A lot of other low interest debt, like, maybe just a couple of, credit card loans here and there. I think it amounts to close to $40,000. Anyway, long story short is, I'm thinking I'd like to maybe bump up, how should I use that inheritance, right? Should I use it as one lump sum into a retirement so that I can, try to, boost the amount for my retirement a little bit faster? Or does it make sense to, set aside the 3 to 6 months cash, take care of some of those things first, and then what's ever left over, put that into the retirement?
Yeah, it's a great question. What is your age, if you don't mind me asking?
58.
Okay, very good. And you said you've got about $40,000 in debt. Does that include the mortgage, or is that outside of the mortgage?
That's outside the mortgage.
Okay, and you don't currently have an emergency fund, is that right?
We have about $10,000.
Okay, and what are your monthly expenses, roughly?
Yeah, it's probably close to $5,500 a month.
Okay, so let's say it's an even $6,000. If we were to do 3 months expenses, that'd be $18,000. 6 months, $36,000. I think that's a no brainer to put into a high yield savings account. That gives you some sort of buffer for the unexpected. I would wipe out those credit card loans, especially if a good bit of those are on credit cards, just because with interest rates heading higher, any of those that have variable rates, those are headed north, and that's a guaranteed return equal to that interest rate. So let's say we were to put, $25,000 into the emergency fund, or if you don't feel like you need that much, maybe $15,000 since you've already got, $10,000 set aside. And then we were to take the $40,000 and wipe that out. That's $55,000. So that would leave you with $145,000 left. You're not going to be able to just drop that into a retirement account. I mean, if it's a 401k, it has to come through salary deferral. So the best way to do that is basically to maximize what you can put into your 401k up to the contribution limit for this year, which is a little more than $20,000. And even if that pulled your income down lower than what you need to cover your expenses, then you could offset that by pulling from the inheritance money. And so essentially you're getting, it's a way to get that inheritance money into the 401k through salary deferral by living on it and just really dropping your paycheck, if you can follow me on that. The other option is to, put, some money into Roth IRAs. You could put $7,000 each, you and your wife, into two Roth IRAs since you're over the age of 50. So that would cover, at least $14,000 of that. So those would be two options. Beyond that, you could look at accelerating the payoff of your home. You could also look at I-bonds, which would be another great option. They're paying 9.7% right now. You could put in up to $20,000 between you and your wife, $10,000 apiece this year. And, that great rate of return is something backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. So there's not any risk there, but you would have to leave that in for at least a year. So those are some ideas to consider. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, sounds great. I mean, I think what I've heard from, and what I needed clarification on was, how much of that lump sum could I put into a retirement of some sort? And because I've never faced this situation before, right, where I've had a lump sum amount of money to do something like that with. So No, that's really helpful. Some have suggested maybe some real estate potentially, you know, as an option, and then use that as an investment option. But I'm not 100% comfortable with that, obviously, with some of the debt that's there. I mean, even though I have bonuses that have been coming in each year, I feel confident I can pay off the debt that way over the next couple of years.
Sure.
It just makes me feel a lot more comfortable based on your recommendation.
Yeah. Do you have, do you each have 401ks, you and your wife, or just you?
We do, yes.
Okay.
Her value is quite a bit lower at this point, but the total between both of us plus IRAs is around $400,000.
Yeah, so if you wanted to get more into it, I mean, you all could each put over the age of 50, $27,000 away into a 401k. That's the limit for this year. So what you would do is you would, again, just go to HR and say, I want to really bump up to the max my salary deferral into my 401k. And if you say, well, that brings my check down low enough where I don't have enough for my bills, then you'd pull from the inheritance money to supplement it. And essentially, you're trading one for the other to get more into those tax-deferred environments. So I think between the I-bonds, paying off the debt, the emergency fund, and the 401k, you're headed in the right direction. We'll be right back on MoneyWise Live. Thanks for joining us today on MoneyWise Live, biblical wisdom for your financial decisions. Headed back to the phones to Boynton Beach, Florida. Hey, Lisa, thank you for calling. Go right ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate your wisdom and all.
Thank you.
So, yeah, my husband and I, he's 58, I'm 52. We have two children, one in 10th and one that's a senior. We bought this house. We owe about just under $100,000, and we have about that much in cash to our name. The reason we had moved was my husband wanted a garage, so he could do his generator work out of there and all. And but he may change career paths because his back, he's had some issues. I just took on a new job, and then a week later, he's been faced with some health issues just out of the blue. He's bouncing back strong, but we're still not quite 100% if he's going to stay his course or shift into another career. So I guess our question is, should we pay the house off, build the garage, or just keep the cash and keep the same, you know?
Sure. Yeah. Great question. So you said $100,000 is the cash that you have, and that's all in, correct? I mean, you don't have an emergency fund separate from that.
Correct. And to build the shell of this 2,000 square foot building, which would add on to our home, and it would add value, it'd be about $90,000 for the shell. And then, you know, we could do it, you know, it'd all be closed. And that's then we'd have to add a roof and on top of that, so about another $25,000. So probably all of it, even if we did it ourselves, probably $140,000, $150,000. It's, do we wait on that, you know, being the kids are going to be gone, or because I forgot to tell you, he's got a $2,200 a month building that he pays for a 1,400 square foot building, and it's going to go up in August.
And so if he had this additional renovate, or excuse me, this add on to your home, he'd be able to drop that $2,200 a month?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And were you all planning to do this add-on anyway, or that one's still kind of up in the air?
I mean, yeah, we'd like to. There, you know, it would add value to the property. It's a 1-acre lot. It's right now currently about 1,650 square feet. If we did the garage, it would add a master in the back and then a room up front. So in essence, it would be like our retirement, you know, the home.
Yeah, very good. And what right now, how much are you all saving a month? What is your surplus on a monthly basis?
Well, things have kind of shifted and changed. The kids' expenses are pretty high. You know, my daughter does lessons, so, and then her concerts and travel, and then travel baseball. So those are our biggest expenses.
Do you have anything left over at the end of the month typically?
Well, it's been volatile just because it hasn't been consistent. Typically, no, because when we bought this house, it overall, no, we haven't.
Last question. What are your total monthly expenses, roughly?
Let's say about $5,000 to $55,000.
Okay. All right. Well, so here's my thoughts. I wouldn't pay off the house right now unless you all just had a real conviction to do so. That would just put you in a tough spot in terms of having access to cash, even though I love the fact that you would be debt free and I want you to be debt free down the road. I don't think now is the time to do it. So I'd take that off the table if it were me. The second thing is I really want you to have at least 3 months expenses, especially if you're living paycheck to paycheck. 6 months would be even better, but at a minimum three. So that's 15,000 of the 100,000 at a minimum, or 30,000 if you'd feel more comfortable with 6 months expenses that goes into a liquid savings account. We don't touch that. And then I'd love for you guys to be able to build the garage as soon as you can, especially because it allows you to drop this $2,200 a month, and that's continuing to climb. The question is whether you'd be able to service the debt on it, because let's say you just go with $15,000 in the emergency fund, that leaves you $85,000 for the add-on. But if it's going to cost you $150,000, you still have roughly $65,000 that you'd have to get as a home equity loan. And if you're living paycheck to paycheck and you still have the $2,200 a month during construction, I would have some concerns about your ability to service that debt. So it seems like what you may want to do is just continue to save and wait on this property, a little bit longer, unless you feel like, it would be worth it to get it built, and drop that $2,200 a month, which would then be available to service the debt. I'm just concerned about the interim period. Let's say it takes 12 months for it to be built. I mean, that's a year's worth of debt service that you'd have to pull from your savings, and you'd have to account for that because you'd be going underwater as you try to service that, $65,000 home equity line of credit or loan, not line of credit. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And then, of course, the rent or the lease is up in August. So then he has to sign a 3-year lease. To continue that, which we could probably get the shell built by then. But then the other thing is being with his back, he's getting tired. Is that the wise decision? He might sell his business, shift into an office job. There's a lot of question marks,
Well, I think given all that uncertainty and his health, I'd probably just push the pause button on all of this, and I'd really focus on shoring up that emergency fund. I'd hang on to this cash. I'd stay, start to contribute as you can to, maybe you take a portion of this and put it into IRAs so you're saving for the future. But I think right now you just need to focus on dialing back your expenses as best you can so you all can live within your means. And then perhaps once you have a little bit more clarity down the road about his health and his future work situation, perhaps that's the time then to think about whether or not you're going to build this add-on. Does that make sense?
Yep, very much
okay.
So.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you for your call today. We appreciate you very much. Let's stay in Florida. Lori, you're next on the program. Go ahead.
Hey, I just needed a couple quick questions. One is clarification on Medicare and Social Security. I have a friend I'm trying to help navigate. She's retired. She just turned 65, and she was told by her former employer that she didn't qualify for Medicare or Social Security. She does get a pension, and it seemed to be something about because she chose to get a pension that she doesn't qualify for Social Security. Does that sound right?
It could be true, absolutely. So depending upon whether you paid into the Social Security system, and some people don't when they have a pension, would determine whether or not you actually qualify for Social Security benefits. So to be eligible for most types of Social Security benefits, you have to have earned 40 credits. You get one credit for each quarter you work and pay FICA taxes, and that's the real issue. Was there FICA taxes being withheld from her pay? So 4 credits a year, that's 10 years of work. Now, if you worked at some type of job where FICA taxes were not withheld, you wouldn't be eligible for those Social Security benefits. And some people won't be eligible for Medicare if they or their spouse didn't contribute for the at least the 10 years as well. So SSA.gov is the place to go, but that is absolutely true, depending upon her situation, that she may not qualify for benefits if the FICA taxes were not being withheld based on kind of her work situation. Does that make sense?
Yes, perfectly. And then real quick, my own situation, if I were to sell my residence, my only home, and buy a new home, I guess I have up to $250,000 profit before I would have to pay taxes. Is that
correct? True. Yeah, if you've lived there 2 out of the last 5 years as your primary residence, as an individual, you have $250,000 worth of gain on that property. So that would be the selling price minus the purchase price minus the transaction costs and any improvements you put into the property that stayed with the property to enhance the value. All that would be subtracted from the selling price to determine your gain. And as long as that's under $250,000 as an individual, $500,000 as a married couple, then you would not pay any capital gains tax.
Do I have any certain amount of days that to get a new house where any amount of profit would not be taxed? Okay.
No. As long as you stay under that $250,000 mark, you're thinking of something called a 1031 exchange, which is not related to your primary residence, but where you're taking the gain and rolling it into another similar property. This would be for an investment property, typically. You have a window of time where you have to redeploy that money. That does not apply for the exclusion we're talking about here when it's your primary residence. Whether you don't ever buy another piece of property, you still enjoy that $250,000 that you don't pay capital gains on.
Okay. And the purchase price, I actually built the home, so we had the lot and then we had construction loan. So you would just put those two amounts together for the purchase price of the home originally.
Yeah, that's right. I would check with a tax preparer just to make sure you establish that basis properly and calculate the true gain. If you feel like you're going to be close to $250,000, you want to make sure you get that right. If you feel like you're well within, you know, the limits of $250,000 for an individual, $500,000 for a married couple, you're probably fine. But if you want some help determining exactly what that is, I would check with your CPA or accountant. Okay.
Okay, thank you so much.
You are welcome. Thanks for calling very much. Joanne, I see your question here from Tennessee. You want to know about the rate on I-bonds. You said they're changing in November. I thought once you signed up for the rate, it would remain the same for 6 months, and that's not the case. So no matter when you sign up, that rate adjusts twice a year. It adjusts in November and then again in May. And it's going to adjust for everybody, whether you've held it for 6 months or not. So you will get a new rate come November with those I-bonds. Thanks for checking in with us on the program. MoneyWise Live is a partnership between Moody Radio and MoneyWise Media. Thank you to my team today, and thank you for being here as well. Come back and join us tomorrow. Bye-bye.